Welcome to episode 79. I don't care. I'm not waiting for you, Maladdin. I'm starting. I'm taking over this podcast. Extra Sequential, the pop culture comic book podcast coming at you from Perth. My name is Chris, and representing Melbourne is young Lucaton, who is young, at least a decade younger than me.
Well, since I control the means of production on this podcast, I could edit your voice out at any moment I so choose.
You sound like you're working in a Colombian textiles factory.
Quiet, you. The workers will rise up. On this week's show, Chris, what are we discussing? Yes. What are we doing?
We are discussing comics that kind of get announced and then never get released, or series that never get completed. The last 10 years have just seen a veritable glut of similar projects that have kind of just floundered and been on people's wish lists. So we're going to run through a whole bunch of mainly superhero-themed issues.
And not if I have something to say about it.
Yes. Okay. You can be the yin to my yang.
Yeah. So talking about your yang, every podcast you bring it down.
How are you?
I am well. I have been enjoying my time off, as it were, catching up
are
on lots of comics
hairy?
Reading. Yes, I am. I was going to be all indignant.
Interviews and like, you're not becoming.
Well, if any potential employers are listening, I am clean shaven and very well presented.
You're wearing a suit as we speak.
Yeah, always. I sleep in one. Sleep in a three-piece suit. Yeah, I've been catching up on lots of reading. The local library has like an enormous comic book section, so I've been borrowing just about everything. So catching up on so many titles I've never read or gotten around to. It's a great.
Excellent. Yes, I actually just visited the new Perth Library, which has just moved above the underground and train station in Perth, obviously. And, they've got the it took me a while to find the comics section because they only moved in a few days ago. But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that I had my eye on. Mm. But the only book I got out was The Complete Idiot's Guide to Screenwriting. But I will go back to – but, yeah, I should point out that I've read a couple of Dark Horse comics, most notably BPRD, Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense, and Star Wars Dawn of the Jedi, which talks about how, well, basically the Jedi's origins. So they're both a broken frontier.
So a prequel to the prequels.
It's kind of set like, you know, centuries and centuries ago, but it's, yeah, so it doesn't have any Skywalkers or anyone like that in it. But it's kind of interesting. I mean, I guess I'm surprised it wasn't more controversial when they announced this, because I remember when they talked about Wolverine's origin. Mm-hmm. When I said, we're finally going to tell Wolverine's origin, and that was kind of controversial because his mystery was a great part of his character. But, yeah, this is the first time, as far as I'm aware, that the actual, you know, where do the lightsabers come from? Where do the name Jedi come from? What is the, you know, who were the first Jedi? How did they get trained? So this series, miniseries, Dawn of the Jedi, focuses on that. But, yeah, I haven't read too much controversy or whatever, but maybe just people are bedazzled by a 3D Phantom Menace to notice.
Yeah, in a daze. So, I caught up on something that I don't know if you've ever read any Love and Rockets, Chris.
No, but I was actually, because yeah, you and I both said, I think last week off air, that it's a series that has received a lot of acclaim and we've never read any of it, and I actually looked for some at the library but did not find any, but I'm assuming you have.
Yeah, I popped my Hernandez cherry, as it were. That's right, and I got a taste of both of the brothers, I guess, and their writing style, because I read High Soft Lisp and New Stories Volume 3, and I've got to say Gilbert Hernandez is no Jamie Hernandez.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Gilbert's much more outlandish. They're both Jamie's just got much more kind of realistic, down-to-earth approach to characterization and what happens to characters, whereas Gilbert Hernandez, the amount of huge boobs and softcore porn films that pop up in his stories is kind of incredible. So, yeah, but I'd still recommend this series, and I'm going to look up more volumes if I can. Just probably stick to Jamie for now. If you're a defender of Gilbert Hernandez, let me know how wrong I am on the Facebook Extra Sequential site.
Sounds like the Gallagher brothers of the comics world.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the opposite, because the more down-to-earth one is the more popular one in the Hernandez's case, if you follow. So, I'd like to get into the comic book news, if you're so ready. Now, there's been one news item that's been dominating the news.
And before Watchmen, yeah, I know.
Stop, no. We talked about that. Stop it. No. We promised we'd never mention this again on the podcast, or I did. No, this week, there's been another legal battle, and you add it to another long list of warfare between publishers and writers. But Gary Friedrich, one of the co-creators of Ghost Rider for Marvel Comics, has been ordered to pay $17,000 in damages and seek no further profit from the character, also that he can't market himself as the creator of Ghost Rider. Now, this has got quite a few people up in arms, and there's a bit of history to the lawsuit. It's a reaction to another lawsuit. I mean, what's your were you even aware of this before this announcement?
I have, yeah, the actual lawsuit after the first Ghost Rider film came out, which is no surprise. It seems to be a recurring thing that Gary Friedrich, who co-created Ghost Rider, but depending on who you ask, the writer and the editors, he had varying degrees of actual hand involvement in it. But yeah, he sued Marvel because he's like, oh, you're making all this money from the Ghost Rider film. I co-created Ghost Rider. So he sued them about 5 years ago. These things take forever, as we know. So, we'll put a link up because only a matter of hours ago, there was an interview on Comic Book Resources with Joe Quesada and the other editor whose name I forget, talking about this without going into too much detail because they can't, it's still ongoing. But basically they're saying, you know, it's not Marvel's. It's something that Gary Friedrich's lawyers and Marvel / Disney's lawyers agreed upon.
Yeah.
But it's been very bad PR for Marvel because, Gary Friedrich, he hasn't worked in the industry for years and years. He's, I think, 69 years old. He's broke as, which happens to a lot of these creators, unfortunately. Mm.
Well,
yeah.
Well, the lawsuit on Marvel's attempt to, you know, take away all his rights and these damages is in response to the initial lawsuit he filed. He demanded ownership of the character because of, I think, Marvel misfiled a copyright application in 1971, so it technically should have been there, and he didn't really have a leg to stand on. A few pieces worth noting, like the damages they're seeking is for merchandise he was selling. Yes. Now, we should mention Gary Friedrich was the writer, so the merch he was selling was actually prints of Mike Ploog's artwork. He's the co-creator, and as well as other Marvel artists' artwork, which he'd sell and then on top of that, a fee for his signature, which a lot of exhibitors do at cons, I suppose. But it's worth pointing out first, it's not his work, and then they're charging him for the intellectual property. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But it's a whole big legal kerfuffle. I mean, with licensing laws, Marvel and DC have always turned a blind eye to creators selling merchandise at cons, which is technically illegal. It is, licenses implied if the copyright holder remains silent, which is the case here. So there's a strong argument to be made that they've allowed it for so long that they have no right to complain about it now. But people have come down pretty hard on Marvel on this, and I'm probably more of a devil's advocate stance here. I might be on more on Marvel's side, but I'd like to hear what you think first.
A couple of things before I get to that I did want to mention was a couple of new developments. Yeah, a lot of, I know Steve Niles, 30 Days a Night writer, and Batman, he's, and a lot of other creators have got on board Gary Friedrich's side and have begun raising funds for him. So hopefully if all goes well, he won't actually have to shell out $70,000 out of his own money, which he doesn't have. So, I mean, it warms the cockles of my heart because the comics industry is quite close and you wouldn't find this in any other industry, really. Sean Murphy, artist of Joe the Barbarian, Hellblazer, he's publicly said that from now on he's not going to do any commissions anymore.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of playing it safe. He's actually on a DC exclusive contract, so he might be able to get some loopholes there and just write, just draw only or sketch only DC characters. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I mean, hopefully that won't stop, as you said, the artists doing commissions, because that's how a lot of these former artists who are no longer the top of their game. Mm. That's how they make their income these days. And, you know, especially in America, it's not like they have, you know, all the wonderful healthcare benefits and that we have here. They do have the Hero Charity, which looks after comic creators that have fallen on hard times. Thankfully, to look after people like Gary Friedrich in cases like this, though they haven't said that they will. I still don't know what to think. I mean, yeah, I understand that's not Marvel themselves actually forcing them over $17,000, but. And it's such a hard business to, you know, I mean, the comics business, I mean, you compare it to the music business. I mean, you've got maybe Madonna and U2 are the only acts I can think of that have consistently put out popular music since their career started, you know. But, I mean, most other kind of musical acts or even movie stars over a 5-10 year period and then they're gone and they, you know, start working on TV or pantomime. And the same kind of thing is comics. You know, we don't know if Grant Morrison's still going to be working 10 years from now. And a lot of the kind of writers and artists from the 60s and 70s aren't working in the industry anymore because public tastes change or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for these guys, you know. So, I mean, hopefully they can still continue to make residual income. I mean, Ghost Rider's a good character. However, you and I have both worked in the architecture industry and you know, those employment contracts are pretty hefty.
Which and, I'm sure it's the same case for their comic, like for their page rates or however they're paid for scripts and creations. I understand their check also, when they receive a check, the contract is on the back.
Yeah, and so Marvel, I mean, so they go into it saying that, yeah, I mean, Marvel and DC, you're, even if you create characters, you know, for Superman supporting cast or wherever, you don't own Jimmy Olsen. You know, you work for Marvel, you work for DC, they pay you any intellectual property. That's what you're paid for. So even in our industry, you can imagine how airtight their contracts would be. We don't know how airtight they would have been in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But
we'll say on a moral level, does he have any further right to demand a share of the character's success after his tenure on the character?
I guess not. Well, from a moral standpoint, perhaps he does because, you know, the money, the studios are still making, assuming both Ghost Rider films, the sequel of which I think just came out this week, assuming both films are successful and profitable, mm-hmm. you would hope that, I mean, those films wouldn't have been made if it wasn't for Gary Friedrich and Mike Plug and the other guys creating Ghost Rider. Mm-hmm. So, but it's hard. I mean, when they created Ghost Rider 30 years ago, I mean, they wouldn't have sworn that, you know, crazy Nicolas Cage would have been urinating fire for $1 million, but they wouldn't have seen that. You know, I mean, comics still back then in the 70s were still kind of almost disposable kind of literature. So,
well, I do think with this whole, there's almost a little bit too much credit put on creators in some of these cases. Not so much the case in, say, Siegel and Shuster's, who created basically a whole genre and, kind of, helped build a publisher. In cases like this, the success of Ghost Rider is as much in part due to Marvel's distribution, their product visibility, you know, their marketing.
Probably and all the other creators that have come on since Friedrich and built the mythology in the last 30 years.
Yeah, but there's no way. It seems very unlikely to me that a character like Ghost Rider or any many other superhero characters could have been as financially successful on their own, say, self-publishing and so forth, if, and in this case, Marvel and DC and so forth, they take on the weight of that risk, not the creators. They get paid no matter if Ghost Rider is a failure or not. So, in most business, you're paid in response to how much risk you're taking on. And work for hire creators have no risk involved in their work. They're paid, or the risk is if they get further work, I suppose. But accordingly, the company which took the most risk publishing, spending their money, putting out a physical comic has reaped the rewards. And should they throw a bone to Gary Friedrich every now and then? For sure. But is he due, the lion's share of the character's, worth? I'd say no.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, you would like to think that Marvel, especially now owned by Disney, would kind of do what, you know, DC did after the first Superman film came out, and they gave Siegel and Shuster, you know, a pension since until the day both of them died. And you kind of think that, yeah, Gary Friedrich, you know, sure, he's, you know, 0.1% of the movie's profits go nuts, Gary, or something like that.
Yeah, of course.
But then perhaps they're thinking that it might get murky, and then the letterer might come out and say, I lettered the first issue.
Exactly. I changed this piece of dialogue. I think I came up with his catchphrase when I was in the lift with Gary Friedrich one time.
Yeah,
that kind of thing. It's, I don't know. Like, see, I don't know if you and I, or me especially, that's an unpopular opinion, because it seems that people are very much on Friedrich's side here.
I guess because he's a poor old man.
A sad old man.
If he was a multi, you know, if he was Brian Michael Bendis or Geoff Johns, who was still working today and making lots of money, no one would really feel sorry for him. But it's like the David and Goliath. It's like, how dare you, Marvel, you faceless corporation, you know, take advantage of someone who worked, you know, so I can understand that. But I think the contracts would be vastly different, you know. I mean, that you'd have all the movie and TV and licensing rights signed into anything these days. But again, a lot of there has been kind of I guess a good example would be Robert Kirkman. You know, he's he owns The Walking Dead, even though he's currently being sued as well. Mm. But if you work for a creator owned rather than a Marvel or DC, if you work for Image or one of those guys, you own the character and you make the money, you reap the rewards. But it's obviously a lot riskier. People, movie studios are always going to make films of well-known superheroes rather than some Image comic that came out a few years ago. But hopefully, yeah, The Walking Dead success can change that. But
what's interesting, you bring up The Walking Dead and the original artist, Tony Moore, or I think on the first few issues anyway, Tony Moore, he's he had initially sold off his rights to the series in exchange for a share of the earnings, so Robert Kirkman's sole owner and of it now. But he's claiming that he hasn't received these earnings, nor has he been allowed to look over Kirkman's books to see the actual earnings, which is part of their original contract agreement. And it's in this day and age of Twitter and so forth, Robert Kirkman and Tony Moore have been quite vocal about this whole thing, and people have pointed out that Kirkman has said things on his site in a sarcastic way, which will be used almost certainly against him in the courts. I think people forget that you're not anonymous on the internet, no matter what you say. And even if you crack a joke like, oh, well, if contracts don't work, then backstabbing and stealing will, which is paraphrasing what Robert Kirkman said in regards to what he did as a joke. Mm. But it puts him in an awkward legal position.
And it's interesting that we talked about creative splits a couple of episodes ago, and I think we both mentioned that it's so much more common these days that, you're right, thanks to Facebook and Twitter and blogs, you post that writers and artists that fall apart are a lot more vocal than perhaps they ever used to be, and us as a reading public seeing behind the curtain for the first time, and it's not always nice what we see, is it? You kind of see that the magic isn't always so magical.
It's kind of nice when they keep themselves a bit enigmatic.
Yes. You know what I mean? Like Alan Moore.
Yes, exactly. Let's change the topic here very quickly. We've got some retailer survey numbers for the DC relaunch. So out of the new launch 52 titles, which were supposed to be for getting new readers and so forth, we finally got a bit of data on who exactly was buying these comics. And very quickly, 70% of those buying were avid fans who purchased up to 20 of the 52 titles. More than a quarter were lapsed readers, which is quite a good success, I'd say. And only 5% were first-time new readers.
Yeah, that's got to hurt.
Yeah, and apparently up to 4 in 10 said the titles they were interested in, of the new readers, I should say, said that they were out of stock. So they had 2/3 of them ended up making a spontaneous purchase, and the other third, I guess, left, which is interesting, I suppose.
And it doesn't really bode well for DC. But, I mean,
5% is better than 0%. But I'd imagine a comic store on any given day, you would probably get, 1% to 5% of people who've never been in a comic book store, or any vaguely familiar of them coming in, buying a gift for someone. So these numbers don't seem too different to what you'd normally get in a store, except for the lapsed readers. That seems to be the big thing here. But only 7% of people coming in were female overall. Seven.
I guess there weren't many. I don't know. I guess there weren't many female-centered books, but then do female, that's a discussion for another time. Do females books? Not necessarily.
Well, not necessarily.
They want to read superheroes.
Well, I mean, if you look at a show like Doctor Who, and I'm bringing this up only because IDW is launching a Doctor Who crossover with Star Trek Next Generation coming out soon. Look for that.
You're going to get that?
Out of morbid curiosity. This could be an amazing disaster. Horrible and awesome at the same time. So I'm looking forward to that. But that show, yes, you've got a male lead, but the audience surrogate character is a female. And that show has been hugely popular with women, probably more so than with men, which goes to show your lead doesn't have to be whichever character the audience relates to more is going to be. So, your Lois Lane, if the book's from her perspective, it's going to be more popular as a Superman book with female. I don't know, throwing ideas out.
I guess that's why they made Talking Superman. That's why they made the Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
Mm,
with Dean Cain, who apparently is part Japanese or something.
That was new to me. I only worked that out today. Isn't that amazing?
That is.
Yeah. But this only other piece of info here that I found interesting was that the bulk of the age group was 25 to 44. Very few were under, say, 18, which I don't know if I find that very surprising. Kids these days, they don't read nothing, let alone.
No, they're into video games, my lad.
Yeah, I guess so. But,
but I did want to mention briefly that Kevin Smith, who we'll talk about later once we get into the topic, is his show just debuted this week on AMC, who also do The Walking Dead, his new reality TV show, Comic Book Men. It's only six episodes, but so that's Kevin Smith, film director. He's owns a comic book store, so it's basically a life with his crazy buddies talking about pop culture shenanigans, kind of a more realistic Big Bang Theory, I guess you could say, without all the science talk. So hopefully we get it in Australia, because I'm curious, and you know how much I like me some Kevin Smith. So if you're in America, then watch it and tell us what you think on Facebook.
Chris, your voice is so crystal clear today. I just wanted to point that out.
Well, I've been listening to Dolly Parton, and I've been singing along to her records. She's known as a singer with a crystal clear voice. A song like she's like a sonic waterfall, Maladdin, just melodic and. Is it melodic or melodic? I don't know.
So anyway, you're saying through osmosis, you've gained her ability to speak clearly. Is that
correct.
What's happened? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
Rather than my usual George Bush vocal stylings.
I have no idea. How old are you? You remember? I'm like 10 years younger than you.
A matter of days.
Wow.
Okay, so our feature topic is this week, as previously discussed in the introduction, which seems so long ago now, was comic book projects that haven't materialized. So they're like, you know, politicians that make promises and then just don't hear from them. I don't know.
Let's steer away from politics for this episode. We'll save it for another one. But
we've already done a politics episode. But so I just want to start off on a good note.
Yeah.
You probably don't remember a series that came out many, many years ago called The 12, which was written by J. Michael Straczynski with art by Chris Weston, and it was published by Marvel. It's meant to be a 12-issue series. The 8th issue came out in 2008. We haven't heard anything since. It's basically about World War II superheroes who come back in the modern world. I think they're public domain characters. And it was actually a pretty good series. And then I guess JMS got more and more popular and DC loved him. So the last four issues have actually been finished. So issues 19 and 11 and 12 are actually coming out this year. So finally, from 2008 to 2012, it's going to be finished. Holy Terror, Frank Miller's Holy Terror, which we did a whole episode on that, didn't we?
Yeah, that's right.
That was in development for years and years, and that finally about, 4 or 5 years, I believe, originally as a Batman project as discussed. So then that came out as well. So those are a couple of things that came to mind that actually started, and then we heard nothing, and then they got finished. So hopefully as we go through these lists, others will join them.
Yeah, and we've got a few kind of different examples. I know there's probably a fair few superhero examples. Probably more because the main publishers are more likely to announce what they're working on to gain publicity, whereas some of these other titles, it's probably just less likely anyone's heard of them, or the writers are smart enough to not go telling people what stupid idea they came up with on the back of a napkin, you know, a few months ago when they're cornered by a reporter asking them, "What are you working on, Mr. Miller?" See, that's how these things go.
He often gets cornered. One of the first things that came to mind for me was there was a book written by Les Daniels that came out in 1998 called Superman, The Complete History. He also did a Batman and a Wonder Woman book. And they're basically coffee table books that talk about the history of the characters and all that kind of stuff. And I remember in the last few pages of this coffee table book, there was a couple of pages of pencil art by Barry Windsor-Smith, who... what's Barry Windsor-Smith famous for, Maladdin, Frankenstein, and did he do any Swamp Thing or Sandman?
You're thinking of Bernie Wrightson.
Oh, that's right, I am, thank you. It's the W's that got me confused.
Yes.
So Barry Windsor-Smith, he was basically giving a sneak peek and saying, "Oh, this book's coming out soon," and it never came out. This was in 1998. I managed to find an interview with him which is quite an honest interview. He said, I went to DC last year with this idea for a Superman graphic novel in a big art book format, and Paul Levitz, who was the head of the time, was very pleased with the concept. It was going to be Superman in storyteller style, i.e. a sophisticated story. No exposition. There was to be no flying, no punching, no fighting. It's a story about two people when Superman meets Lois Lane. But it took 7 bleeding months to figure out the contract while I'm sitting poised, pencil in hand. I'll put the link up to the interview online. It's been interesting, but basically he went on to say that he had a plan for this 120-page Superman story, and he was saying, I should never have told of DC about it, because they were kept editorial interference. It just got him frustrated. So he said, I should have just finished it and then given it to them, and then said, here, publish this.
I'm guessing they were trying to work, is there any way we can get Jim Lee to illustrate this?
Well, he was saying there's one of the people that he wrote a scene in the Daily Planet where one of the reporters made a joke that Lois Lane was a virgin, and the editors didn't like that. And then he had another scene where Perry White had some scotch hidden in his desk, and they didn't like that. So a lot of little things like that. So I guess he just got frustrated and said, oh, fine, if that's enough. So it's a shame that, a passion born of, a project born of only passion and not, the signature on a contract could derail so quickly. And I've got quite a few more DC and Marvel examples like that on my list, but I don't want to hog the spotlight, so please take the microphone, Aladdin.
Well, as you mentioned, that was sort of the first one you thought of. The first one that definitely comes to mind for me is Big Numbers, which is a comic by Bill Sienkiewicz and Alan Moore. The great bearded mage, Alan Moore. And it's a comic that it was supposed to be 12 issues, and I believe only the first two ever came out. And in part due to Bill Sienkiewicz's art, if you've seen it, is highly detailed. He's in kind of the Dave McKean world of blending of collage and images and photographs and color, very, very expressionistic artwork. And the comic is told in the real world. It's the effect of a shopping center development on a small English town, much like Alan Moore's native Northampton. And it would have explored mathematics and fractal geometry and chaos theory. And fractal geometry, if anyone doesn't know, it's a geometry which can be infinitely expanded or shrunk down, and all the small details resemble the larger ones. So the scale, you see it in nature, like in rock formations, and the stock market graphs look like that. It's snowflakes, etc., and ferns. I can imagine how it would have worked visually. You know what I mean? So it was kind of exciting. And only 2 issues came out. I know Sienkiewicz worked on issue 3, but he fell behind the workload, and issues 3 and 4, which never came out, were illustrated by his assistant at the time, Al Columbia, great name, who later withdrew and is rumored to have taken his artwork with him.
Okay.
So I know Sienkiewicz ended up publishing some pages of issue 3 without the dialogue, in deference to Alan Moore, in the quickly cancelled magazine Submedia. And apparently in 2009, a lucky buyer on eBay found complete lettered artwork for Big Numbers 3. And with Alan Moore's permission, he published all the scans of the lettered artwork online. So 3 issues came out of this.
Out of 12.
And I know at the time it was billed as, Alan Moore's next great masterpiece, because this was around the From Hell period. And it's a shame it never got completed. And he said, it's not going to happen now. I've moved on. I think it's going to go down as one of those lost masterpieces from one of the great writers in comic books.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, I think if I was in a similar kind of situation, I'd just, publish all my scripts online or something, just give people a bit of a tease. I guess it's kind of like TV shows that get cancelled on a cliffhanger or whatever. You kind of want to know what happens next,
And it's not the first Alan Moore work for this to happen too. We mentioned 1963, the comic he was putting out through Image with Steve Bissett and others. And you mentioned just then, why didn't you just put out the script work? And I understand that point of view. William S. Burroughs did the same thing with his long, long non-published book, Arpuk Is Here. With artist Malcolm McNeil, and that first appeared as under the title The Unspeakable Mr. Hart in the magazine Cyclops in 1970, or the first installment of it. And it was supposed to be a big 120-page, fold-out, continual narrative And they worked on it for 7 years. And in the end, they couldn't find a publisher who was willing to take the risk, which I find crazy these days. You have to remember, you know, 1970s wasn't the age it is now in terms of high concept graphic novels. I mean, if you can get Kramer's Ergo, you know, enormous books coming out, it seems strange that this wouldn't. But yeah, they were hesitant at the time, publishers were. So Text Form was put out in 79, and the original art's mostly completed, but some of it's uncolored, and that's it. So in 2010, Fantagraphics announced they'd be publishing it in the summer of 2011. And that passed without comment, that date.
So,
however, yeah, I contacted Fantagraphics last week for an update, to which a rep kindly informed me that the book's taking a different form and it's being split into two books, which are coming out later this year, probably later in summer. So that'll be an American summer, so mid-year. So that means I would assume that means September. That's a good dumping point for these things. But a book which is taken some, 40 years now to come out, is finally seeing print. So this is very exciting news, especially to fans of William S. Burroughs. He's the writer of Naked Lunch, quite a famous kind of beat writer in the 70s. So
yes. Ah, good work. Ah, that would be good. It's good when things work out like that, because most of these on this list don't, such as, and I've got quite a few DC on my list, so All-Star Wonder Woman. This was going to have rare interiors by Adam Hughes. Adam Hughes, you'll know, who's the cover artist who does all the sexy girls with
Cheesecake.
Catwoman and Cheesecake, correct. So DC started publishing their All-Star line, which is kind of their version of Marvel's Ultimate line, I guess. So All-Star Superman, 12 issues of that came out with Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. All-Star Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder, that finished with issue 10, I believe, 2008. And nothing kind of happened with it. I think there was supposed to be an All-Star Batgirl as well. That never happened. But, yeah, All-Star Wonder Woman, written and drawn by Adam Hughes. He's very rare that he does interior art, so that was going to be quite exciting. But again, nothing has happened from that yet.
That seems like an editorial thing. I'd imagine like the same problem that Barry Windsor-Smith had probably happened with Wonder Woman. DC wanted to decide which direction to take the character in, and they've never known what to do with her, really.
No, and the All-Star line basically just died. It doesn't really exist anymore. Hasn't existed for, you know, well, yes, as I said, since 2008. So perhaps they thought, well, it's too risky. But now Adam Hughes is on, before Watchmen, he's doing the Dr. Manhattan series. So he's illustrating all the four issues of that. So who knows when I'll get back on that. So it's not happening anyway. Sticking with DC, Batman, who's quite notorious, and he's a character that's probably got more cancelled or non-eventuating series than anybody else. And I think we both had Batman Europa on our list, and that sounded really interesting. It was actually announced way back in October 2004. It's a four-issue miniseries that was going to be written by Brian Azzarello with art by a different European artist, so not necessarily a household name, but a different European artist on each of the issues with, I think, painted art by Jim Lee was going to do one issue as well. So I remember it was actually on the cover of previews. That's how confident they were when it came out. So we saw the kind of the Jim Lee cover, and that looks pretty cool. But we haven't heard anything about it since. So I think it was supposed to come out about a year ago, the first issue. But as I said, yeah, none of those four issues have been released as yet. So it's a shame. I don't know. Perhaps the European artists are slower, but who knows.
I think DC, I think what happened there is more DC's game plan changed drastically mid last year. They knew what was in the works, and they probably wanted to shuffle people around appropriately. I mean, Jim Lee's had his plate full. I mean, that's part of the reason why, I know, All-Star Batman and Robin, the last two issues were supposed to come out in 2011. And there's been like a 2 year hiatus, 3 year hiatus. And I think even between the issues, 8 and 7, there was like a 1 year gap. It was never published regularly. But, it seems at this point, like nobody knows when the last bunch of issues will be put out. I guess that's just because the company's taken a different direction. And you see these things. It's when they announce things so early in the game. And no one's even picked up a pen except Jim Lee, who's just drawn a 2-minute sketch. You know,
it's interesting. I'll Yeah, I'll talk about that later because, yeah, that's one of the things that I thought of. Like, yeah, they announced it too early. But I know that one thing DC have done recently was just before the reboot, Grant Morrison's Batman Incorporated, when just before the line-wide reboot happened in September of last year, Grant Morrison wanted to wrap up his Batman Incorporated storyline. So DC, a couple of months ago, released a, like, double-sized extra, you know, extravaganza with all those issues that were no longer in continuity. They've just published. So here's the last three or four issues as a big, thick annual type book. So, I mean, that's their publishing alternative. That's one option that they can do. So if All-Star Batman and Robin ever finishes, perhaps that's one they can do. They can just publish all three or four issues together, the last two issues. But anyway, sticking with All-Star.
Before you move on, I mean, Grant Morrison comes up a lot in these lists. He had a huge plan for a big hyper-continuity infinite crisis.
Yes, multiversity. Right. I don't know much about that, but yeah.
And that was just planning stage, so that probably doesn't count. But, I mean, a lot of people have grand visions which never get realised. But, yeah, you're mentioning All-Star.
Yeah, Dark Knight, The Boy Wonder, which was going to be a follow-up to the, as previously discussed, never concluded All-Star Batman Fraud, written by Frank Miller without by Jim Lee. That was going to be a six-part miniseries basically focusing on Robin on the All-Star continuity. And it was supposed to come out in February of last year. Ba-bomb, nothing yet. Kevin Smith, I wanted to talk about in Aladdin, as I often do.
Do we have to?
Yes. Now, he's the writer, director of Clerks, Mallrats, Red State, the director of Cop Out, which is a bad film. But anyway, so he's written for both Marvel and DC, and most of what he's written has been notoriously late. Most famously is Spider-Man Black Cat, The Evil That Men Do, was a miniseries, and there was a three-year wait between issues three and four. Batman Widening Gaia was announced as, I believe, two separate six-issue miniseries because they knew that Kevin Smith was very, very slow because he's a Hollywood writer and director as well as being a comics writer.
He's a big guy.
And a podcast extraordinaire. So I know when White and Gaia was announced, DC said, look, we can't trust Kevin Smith to do 12 issues, so we're going to split it in half. We're going to get the six issues out of the way, and then we're going to do the last six issues. The first six issues came out, I believe, but we haven't seen any announcement about the second series of six issues. So that's most unfortunate. And the other one, I guess most notorious, is Daredevil Bullseye, The Target, which was supposed to be a miniseries with painter Glenn Fabry, but only one issue came out, and that was 10 years ago in 2002. Nothing has been announced about that since. So Kevin Smith is perhaps the most notorious of people on this list, I guess he just gets sidetracked. He's not just a comics writer. He's quite a multitasker with a lot of plates spinning. But, yes, as you said, really Marvel and DC should see all the work that's finished before they announce it rather than get all too excited.
Or put more excitement into non-Superman, Batman projects. That would be nice.
You're speaking like a foolish man.
A foolish man. But, okay, Kevin Smith is probably a bone of contention for you and I. And I don't know if listeners of the show have picked up on it, but I find him a repugnant personality. That's probably further than I would normally go, but it is a podcast, so I have to play it up. But he reminds me of... Every comic store has a certain kind of customer who comes in, is rude to all of the staff and everyone else there, has a too long a conversation with one of the staff members who's completely uninterested. They're opinionated and rude about anyone else's opinion, and otherwise just the kind of people you just want to not spend any time with. Whereas for some reason, fans have really... I don't know, come to love Kevin Smith, although he encapsulates everything that's wrong with comic book fandom in terms of his personality. I don't want to talk about his work here because that's a whole other example, but he seems to be popular for his personality, and that's part of the reason why he's got his TV show that he's doing now and a bazillion podcasts and comedy shows and so forth and doing speaking tours, which I believe you were going to attend, one of those.
Yes, but I sold out. But he's a very good writer. He knows his comics, he knows his fan base, and he's in touch with his fans. He's not someone who's distant. And, you know, he's not like in the Hollywood hierarchy and royalty, so he can afford to speak his mind because, you know, most people on the street really have no idea who he is. But I like it when, you know, kind of celebrities and stuff will work in comics and kind of do what they can to kind of promote I guess you don't see it as a promotion, but I don't hate the guy. What's your problem, man?
Well, it's
because he's got a beard.
It's his arrogance, Chris, his arrogance. He's the kind of man.
Arrogant.
He's the kind of man who, if a critic gives him a bad review of, I think it was Cop Out, he then banned that critic from any future screenings of any of his films ever and was personally attacking this person. He's not the kind of guy who can take not just criticism, but anyone disagreeing of his point of view. He's like the kind of trolls you see on internet chat rooms, except for some reason people find him awesome and I don't know, there's this cult of personality around Kevin Smith, which I just find baffling. So, yes, now that I've potentially alienated half of our audience or started a feud with Kevin Smith and this tiny, tiny
his
podcast.
Posse.
His posse. Well, he has a huge posse. It is possible that someone will report this back to him and he'll destroy us. And I say, bring it. We could use the publicity.
And I would like to say, Mr. Smith, that the views of Milan and Lincoln do not necessarily represent the views of Extra Sequential or its affiliates. Oh, dear. Before we get into Marvel, I want to talk about Image Comics and Image United. Now, talking about bold projects, this was written by Walking Dead creator we talked about before, Robert Kirkman, and it was illustrated by all the original Image founders, I believe, which is Todd McFarlane, Eric Larson, and Will Spataccio, Mark Silvestri, Rob Liefeld, and Jim Valentino, and Jim Lee was going to provide the covers. And I think the first three issues of the proposed six came out, and that was it. But basically, it was all the different Image characters teaming up. So you had Spawn and whatever the other Image, Savage Dragon, and all those characters, Invincible, teaming up, and some worldwide kind of crisis. So it was, I think it was billed as Image's first, you know, what Marvel and DC do so well, their first big summer crossover event, but yeah, only half of the proposed issues ever came out a couple of years ago, and we haven't heard anything since. Should we move on to Marvel?
Well, I'm happy to do that. I don't have many Marvel examples anyway, so I'm handballing the ball.
Okay, shut up and listen and take notes then. Captain America White, which I mentioned on our kind of
racist.
Creative partnerships.
Sorry.
Creative partnerships episode of creative partners that we'd like to see get back together, Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. So they did Daredevil Yellow, Spider-Man Blue, and Hulk Grey, their series of miniseries focused on the origins and kind of emotional complexities of these superheroes, and Captain America White was going to be the next one. But all that we got was a Zero issue, which came out in July 2008, and we haven't heard anything about the any other issues. So I don't know what Tim Sale is doing now. He doesn't really do much comic work at all. But Jeff Loeb is quite busy with not any other Marvel stuff, but also on TV. So I think he's one of the writers or executive producers of the new Ultimate Spider-Man TV series.
What about the new Teen Wolf TV series? Is he involved with that?
So it's still around, actually. Did that get cancelled?
Well, on Australian television, so that means we're only just seeing it. It may have got cancelled 5 years ago, for all I know.
Yeah, true. Sticking with Jeff Loeb, he was supposed to do a Spider-Man series with J. Scott Campbell. J. Scott Campbell has done Danger Girl with Image Comics. He's done a few Spider-Man issues over the years. He's the one who kind of draws women posing in unnatural poses. You might have seen that famous Mary Jane Watson cover where she's sitting on the sofa with her legs crossed, holding a cup of cocoa, showing her belly button. Does that ring any bells, Maladon?
No.
I'll have to send you the picture later. Yeah. So they were supposed to team up on Spider-Man, which is kind of going to be their equivalent of Hush, the Batman 12-issue Batman series that Jeff Loeb did with Jim Lee.
Right.
So that was announced in April 2006. But, yeah, nothing has happened of that
since. So can I guess the plot of this comic? So Spider-Man is discovering these murders, and he doesn't know who's committing them, so he goes to visit all of his ex-arch-nemesises who are like, I don't know who's doing the murders. And then it turns out it was his childhood friend or someone who was introduced in the first issue. Am I close?
Well, you're wrong, because there's no such word as nemesises. It's actually nemeses. So
is that correct?
In your face.
Oh, well, I've been schooled.
Kicking it old school. And that reminded me because, getting back to Jim Lee for a minute, I remember when Hush came out, again, like Kevin Smith, I like it and Aladdin doesn't, but I think Hush is pretty awesome. That was actually all done, all 12 issues were done before they announced it, because I think Jeff Loeb, this is, when did this come out, 2004, 2005? Jeff Loeb actually challenged Jim Lee, because by that point Jim Lee hadn't done interior art for years and years. And he said, I'll bet you can't do in, you know, 12 issues of Batman. And Jim Lee kind of rose to the challenge, and he did. So like, DC Comics kept it a secret until all those issues had finished, and then they announced it. So they were guaranteed that there was never going to be any lateness with that. So, but so, now.
So did Jim Lee then say, I bet my dad could beat up your dad?
It was, well, it wasn't like a, it was like a friendly dare, like a friendly ribbing. It wasn't a playground taunt. We know the comic book industry is filled with mature people. So, you know, Jim Lee's now doing Justice League in America, obviously. Well, I think not anymore. Gene Hart is replacing him, but anyway. But lastly, sticking with Marvel, one penultimate time, Astonishing Captain America was supposed to come out, a miniseries was supposed to come out before the film. The film came out in July of last year. Astonishing Captain America was a miniseries that was announced in late 2010, written by Andy Diggle, Green Arrow Year One, The Losers, with art by Adi Granov, who did, he's got the highly kind of CGI looking, very textured, realistic artwork of Iron Man Extremis, and then he went to work as a conceptual artist for the two Iron Man movies. So that was announced. So Astonishing Captain America, and then we haven't seen anything. We haven't seen one issue. I think we've seen like a bit of a preview picture, and that's about it.
Okay.
What else have you got?
Well, I guess in Marvel information, in this is back in 2004, mind you. So it's well past you, and it's probably never going to happen. I know Bryan Singer, director of the first two X-Men films, highly successful, kind of revitalized the characters in.
Made Superman Returns. Boo!
Well, that's going to tie into this, but he was a big part of sort of sparking an interest in Marvel and specifically X-Men characters again. He was due to write Ultimate X-Men. I don't think he was going to go to script level, but as a creative director and kind of overseer of, I guess, of the direction of the comic. And that ended up being shelved due to his work on Superman Returns, which is also the reason he didn't work on the third X-Men film, and that one went off the rails. And as you mentioned, yeah, Superman Returns was a bit of a disaster, I'd say.
Oh, yes.
And, well, okay, we've both seen this film, and I can't remember anything that happens in it.
Basically, Superman is like a deadbeat dad, posing and flying, you know, hovering outside Lois Lane's window and spying on him, and it's a bad film.
Because I know Superman fans, like, put up with a lot. I mean, we know comic book fans are racist, and they were happy with Dean Cain being part Japanese. So what was the problem with Superman returning in this case?
Brandon Routh was an excellent Superman, I think the problem, Superman Returns was too much like the original Richard Donner, Christopher Reeve film.
It was set after
the first two films. But you had Lex Luthor coming back. Oh, look, he's crazy about real estate yet again. Like, and he never, Superman hasn't thrown a punch on screen since 1980. It's just ridiculous. So I'm really looking forward to Zack Snyder, who directed Watchmen and Sucker Punch, to bring some life into Superman, or The Man of Steel, as it's called, which comes out mid next year, I believe. So, but yeah, Superman Returns wasn't. I mean, it had some.
Chris, there was plenty of punching in Superman Returns. He punched his self doubt, his issues of inadequacy. He punched those. You're being too literal, Chris. You got to dig deeper. Think like Bryan Singer here. He was like, okay, X-Men are homosexuals in disguise. So Superman is a neurotic, you know, it's like, I'm getting what his thought process was here. You should watch this film again, Chris.
Oh, okay. It's like if Woody Allen directed a Superman film. Boy. Okay. Yeah, it is a tough time being a Superman film at times. I've got one last Marvel.
Go for it.
This is originally was meant to be coming out 2007. It's called Daredevil End of Days. And this was, we talked about the end episode that we did a few, where we had like, and Marvel had these series of like, they have Spider-Man, the end, Hulk, the end, X-Men, the end, Wolverine, Old Man Logan, was kind of going into the future and talking about the end of these characters. So this was going to be the equivalent miniseries for Daredevil, written by Brian Michael Bendis, who was writing a Daredevil at the time, I believe. And David Mack, who worked together when they first took over writing and art of Daredevil, with art from Klaus Johnson, Bill Sienkiewicz, that guy again, and Alex Maleev, who I think Alex Maleev worked on Daredevil art as well. So but nothing has happened. But apparently Brian Michael Bendis told USA Today in June of 2011 that the series was on track for release last year, though as of February this year, obviously, it has yet to even be solicited. So that's unfortunate because, yeah, I think Brian Michael Bendis, David Mack, Klaus Janzer, Bill Sienkiewicz and Alex Maleev doing a Daredevil miniseries, talking about the end of Matt Murdock's life, that could that holds a lot of promise. So it's kind of tantalising, but, well, I guess we have to let's discuss why these projects eventually, but I think we have, like, characters become more popular, you know, or Marvel and DC in particular, what their writers and artists do, like you said, focus on something else because there's always editorial shifts and editorial mandate seems to change quite a lot. And the comics industry actually does plan a lot in advance because you have because you're dealing with dozens and dozens of different characters in an intertwined universe, so you can't make random changes that doesn't affect a lot of people. But unfortunately, nevertheless, some of these books slip through the cracks, and pretty much I'd like to see all of the, or most of the ones that I've mentioned, apart from really Image United, don't care too much about that. But the rest of these I'd like to see at some point. But I can understand from a writer's and artist standpoint, when you're hovering over a keyboard or a drawing desk for hours and hours on end, if you're not fully motivated by a paycheck or guaranteed that it's not going to see print, you're not going to put your...
Yeah, or if a publisher's stopping you at every turn, as was the case. Or even just sometimes, you know, we're all human beings and it's easy to forget that in your all these talks of characters and universes, as you mentioned, sometimes a hard drive crashes and a script is lost, which is what happened to Warren Ellis for Desolation Jones. And I guess we just have to understand these things and... These people don't work for us. They're selling us a product, so we have to live with that, I guess.
You're very right.
Yeah.
If we've missed anything, please let us know on the Facebook page or email us, Chris with a K at extrasequential.com. And, I think we've covered most of the most famous ones, and I do want to give a shout-out to Newsarama website, who helped fill in the gaps of my memory as well because they had a good rundown of comic book cold cases, as they called them, mystery projects that have not eventuated. So thank you for that. The internet's a wonderful thing. Thumbs up, Newsarama. So, there's not much more to say, is there, really, Mladen?
No, not really. Music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. Chris obviously mentioned the Facebook. Next week's show will be packed with lots of riveting insights and more Kevin Smith bashing, I'm sure.
And defending. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.